Emily Rapp's world came crashing down, literally, when her prosthetic leg buckled beneath her on a South Korean street, sending her sprawling into a puddle of motor oil. This moment perfectly captures the central tension of her memoir, the fragile facade of normalcy she had constructed versus the reality of her body. Born with proximal focal femoral deficiency, PFFD, Emily's left femur developed abnormally, leading to an amputation at age 4. Her journey from proudly proclaiming, "I might have one leg, but I am not disabled," to embracing her difference reveals a profound truth. Real strength comes not from denying our differences, but from accepting them. At age 6, Emily became the March of Dimes poster child for Albany County, Wyoming. Suddenly, she was everywhere, playing ball, climbing ropes, doing jumping jacks, while reporters photographed and wrote headlines celebrating her normal life despite her disability. For public appearances, she wore a blue velour outfit with matching skirt, her hair in high pigtails with white ribbon bows, smiling while showing off her wooden leg. Her speeches always began, "I might have one leg, but I'm not disabled." When asked what she could do with an artificial leg, she'd list, "I can walk and run and ride a bike, all kinds of things. I swim too." Asked if there was anything she couldn't do, she confidently answered, "No, nothing." People called her an inspiration and brave, and she believed them. She thought that by being exceptional, compensating for her missing leg by being smart, cute, and fun, she would have a normal life. The irony wasn't lost on her later. She was the face of an organization dedicated to preventing people like her from being born. The swimming pool offered Emily her first taste of true physical freedom. Without her glasses, the black lane markers looked like slow-moving caterpillars beneath the rocking water. When she dived in, the cool water made her feel slippery and slick, like the rainbow trout her father taught her to catch and release. In water, her body felt remarkably balanced by buoyancy. Her stump merely bobbed like a buoy while her right leg compensated. Swimming revealed her body as capable of powerful fluid motion. When she rounded her back and tipped into the accepting water, she experienced the beauty of movement while being content with her unique form. Yet even in this liberation, anxiety lingered. At public pools, she worried about her unattended prosthesis. After one was nearly stolen, her cousins took turns guarding it where it leaned against a chair. At slumber parties, she clung to it inside her sleeping bag like a favorite stuffed animal, simultaneously a burden and a necessity, an alien object and an essential part of her identity. Sitting in her friend Melissa's car before a high school bonfire party, Emily stared at her mismatched legs, her wooden prosthesis with metal hinges exposed, contrasting with her pale white right leg. She squeezed her thigh, disgusted with herself. As they approached the party, seeing the bonfire's flames, her anxiety peaked. She imagined herself suddenly legless, forced to hop into that crowd of whole bodies with her scarred stump exposed. The thought was so horrifying that she threw up in her lap. That night, she resolved never to let anyone see her artificial leg or real body. She would diet strictly, work harder than anyone, and maintain perfect control. By joining the trend of girls' obsessions with their bodies, she was, ironically, making herself more normal than ever before. Unable to change her fundamental physical difference, Emily redirected her energy toward controlling what she could: weight, muscle tone, clothing choices. This pattern of compensatory control became a battlefield where her relationship with her body was fought daily. Growing up as a pastor's daughter, Emily inhabited a world where God was unquestionably good. She thrived in worship services and frequently played Mary in church productions, the role temporarily obscuring her thick glasses, wooden leg, and buck teeth beneath the biblical costume. People often told her, "We're always praying for you," and sometimes, "God loves you best of all." Yet Emily maintained an uneasy relationship with prayer, wondering if unanswered prayers reflected God's will or mere coincidence. In fourth grade, preparing for her first communion, Emily believed it would be her healing moment. Wearing a mustard seed necklace, she trusted sufficient faith would transform her body. When her artificial leg remained after communion, she felt her faith had failed. Religion provided both comfort and conflict, a supportive community alongside theology suggesting her body needed fixing. When divine intervention never came, Emily began questioning not only her faith, but whether her body needed fixing at all. As student manager for the seventh grade girls' athletic teams, Emily found her place in sports despite her inability to play. Rising at 4 a.m. during summer and staying late after school, she threw balls at practice, managed equipment, kept score, timed races, and maintained player files. She became the keeper of secrets and gear, celebrating victories as if they were her own. Her friend Sydney affirmed, "You're totally one of us, even though you can't play on the team." Being a phantom player satisfied her. Managing was the next best thing to competing. At home, Emily secretly performed her own versions of team exercises, jump rope, wall sits, running drills, working out in the basement with fierce determination. Though she couldn't match their abilities, she persisted, driven by hope for transformation. This role, present but not fully participating, belonging yet separate, epitomized Emily's adolescent experience. Being team manager allowed her to join the group without confronting her limitations in direct competition, offering inclusion while avoiding potential failure. After years of trying to pass as normal, Emily's breakthrough came when she met with six disabled women from the Lutheran World Federation. On their first night, instead of listing achievements, she drew her body's surgical transformations. She spoke honestly about her disability, confessing, "I think my life is about running," and "I have always hated my body." The women's understanding eyes offered a sisterhood she'd never known. While helping her parents move, her father brought out a box containing all her old prosthetics. They arranged them chronologically, from tiny metal brace to wooden legs of increasing size, each with its own story and nickname. This physical timeline marked the chapters of her journey. When Emily called her doctor about her condition, he revealed it was a spontaneous mutation in her DNA. This discovery angered her. Learning it was literally written into her genetic code felt permanently unfair. As she prepared to box up her legs for the final time, she realized she might never find complete peace with her body, but she had discovered ownership and voice. Standing before pieces of her past, she felt sadness mixed with resignation, finally understanding that her body wasn't a problem to solve, but a reality to embrace.